good, you're here. Just wrapping up 12 presents. Welcome to Life Lab Notes and our holiday series, The 12 Days of Christmas Regifted. We're taking the daily gifts listed in that famous carol and celebrating them in our own way. This is day one, A Partridge in a Pear Tree, a true story about my best friend, Paulette. Written by Sherry Coben.
Oh, you shouldn't have.
There is no such thing as a partridge in a pear tree. Not in nature, anyway. To be clear, no partridge has ever nested or even landed in a pear tree of its own volition to stay there. They're strictly ground nesters. There really is no reason for a partridge to venture boldly onto the branch of a pear tree, or any tree, except to fulfill some mythically greedy bastard's impossibly unfillable Christmas gift wish list. That said, on an otherwise not particularly notable afternoon in the early 1970s, in a chaotic television studio located just across the street from Philadelphia's Liberty Bell, a put-upon partridge perched on the branch of a potted pear tree. For the length of time it took a daytime talk show host, now mostly forgotten, to sing that pesky earworm of a Christmas carol, The 12 Days of Christmas. I never celebrated Christmas until I married a Canadian man of Italian, Irish, and Scottish heritage. I was raised in a non-observant yet culturally connected Jewish family. We lived in several different places when I was growing up, and I appeared in more than one Christmas pageant without complaint. I was always the shortest person in my class and dutifully played the child in most school plays, sitting countless times on various Santa's laps and exclaiming with great, if counterfeit, joy my profound love for the most glittering of holidays and most celebrated of saviors. At home, we lit our menorahs and said our prayers and fried our latkes and played our lame dreidel games and ogled our neighbors' twinkling lights and garish consumerism. I learned all the carols and sang them happily in music class and school assemblies and concerts. The 12 Days of Christmas was the 100 bottles of beer on the wall of Christmas carols. I mastered it early and sang it on the regular for decades without giving it much thought, without doing the math, without ever really bothering to picture it. But this story isn't about my childhood. This story is about my first real job and meeting my best friend on that job, and about some life lessons I learned there and took away. This story is mostly about Paulette, my very best friend of 43 years. While still in college, I got a pretty great job in the art department of Philadelphia's KYW Television, a Westinghouse, aka Group W, owned and operated station. I could always draw, and I still had the energy, stamina, and confidence of youth that allowed me to attend Swarthmore College while holding down a full-time union job. I used a hot press, ran teleprompter, typed on a Chiron, designed news graphics and animation, and perhaps most memorably, eventually inherited the very cool gig of doing portraits of all the Mike Douglas Show's co-hosts that we blew up and painted onto 8-foot circles of homicide board. Those set pieces hung for the week and were used in promotion, then trashed or repainted. A little background. In the early 1970s, women made considerable inroads, storming the gates of previously all-male workplaces. Westinghouse and other corporations responded to pressure, legal and otherwise, and I was part of that first wave of forced hires. There were only a handful of us unwelcome young ladies in IATSE's Union Local 804 at the time, and we bonded rather instantly, the way at-risk sheep bond in a tightly packed flock when a pack of hungry wolves surround them. There were no HR departments back in the day, and I can only say in this hashtag MeToo era that precious few of my male co-workers and superiors would not have deserved to join the ranks of the recently much maligned and shamed Harveys and Rogers and Bills. The halls of KYW were a virtual Wild West of sexual harassment. I was spunky and young, and while we couldn't protest because such rampant and flagrant misogyny was the norm, and there was literally no one to tell, it was kind of stunning. and it served only to toughen me and my resolve. Paulette, a few years my senior, had arrived at KYW a bit sooner than I. I first noticed her on a picket line my very first summer, the summer we went on strike. She was a head shorter than everyone but me, with a huge mane of auburn hair that suited her perfectly. Paulette had more fire in her belly than the rest of the local combined. She cursed like a sailor, as I did, and held her own with a hard-drinking, gruff, and ready guise, and I instantly recognized in her a kindred spirit. We were short, tough, Jewish chicks, the only of our kind in the building. When we first met, Paulette operated camera and did some editing, splicing commercials into local programming. But we IATSE Local 804 employees bloomed wherever we were planted. And eventually, and quite randomly, film school graduate and aspiring documentarian Paulette landed squarely in the green room of The Douglas Show, doing makeup and props, a full-time combination job that might kill other mortals and makes no sense whatsoever. The Mike Douglas Show was a 90-minute talk, variety, daytime shindig taped in front of a live studio audience. It used to be broadcast live until potty mouth Zsa Zsa Gabor spoiled it for everyone, but that's another story. Sadly and short-sightedly, Group W erased most of the Douglas Show tapes, reusing the stock for newer shows every few months. But I can promise you that virtually every famous person in the world showed up there, some for a week at a time. We taped on average 6 shows a week, 5 featuring one co-host and another show with themed hosts, banked so that the show could grab a week off every 5 weeks. Every segment of the show had an associate producer assigned to it, usually a relative neophyte with grand ambitions. The budgets were incredibly low and lead times practically non-existent. One fateful December day in 1974, one of those associate producers had the harebrained idea of Mike singing the 12 Days of Christmas while all the animals and human characters mentioned in the song filled the studio's stage, the very small stage. The exec producer exclaimed, "Let's do it!" And all the mechanics and details fell to the props person, my friend Paulette. This was, I must remind you, decades before the internet. We used the Yellow Pages back in the day. We used landlines. No one yet had answering machines or pagers, let alone texts or email. Some doctors and actors used answering services, but technology hadn't yet caught up with our unlimited, insatiable appetite for information and communication. She had one day's notice to work out booking 12 drummers drumming plus drums, 11 pipers piping plus pipes, 10 lords a-leaping, 9 ladies dancing, 9 ladies, 8 maids a-milking, plus the requisite 8 cows, stools, and buckets, 7 swans a-swimming plus a water feature to paddle in, and in case you didn't know, swans are the total bastards of the bird world, 6 geese a-laying plus nests, 5 gold rings plus hand models, 4 calling birds, 3 French hens, 2 turtle doves, and a partridge in a pear tree. Oh, and handlers for all the freaking birds. So many handlers. And against all odds, she did it. All of it. All those animals showed up, screeching and squawking and mooing and pooping and just generally freaking out. All those animal handlers, one per animal. All those drummers and dancers and lords and ladies and maids, all costumed head to toe in exactly the period you're picturing in your head right now, and coiffed and made up by Paulette. Clogging every square inch of the hallways and outdoor alley were cages and boxes and handcarts and vans and trucks of all description. Start slow. Just picture 8 cows. Indoors. Go ahead. Now picture the mess 8 cows can make. Got it? Good. Now picture the mess 8 completely panicky cows can make. You're starting to get a tiny corner of the whole picture. Add a whole lot of birds, squirting like manic tubes of not at all minty toothpaste. Picture 10 poor bastards, male ballet dancers, leaping, and trying to avoid the increasingly unavoidable puddles of poop and urine and molting feathers. Picture 9 pretty ladies wearing pretty dresses and pretty shoes, dancing in the white and brown goo, their smiles gradually turning to grimaces, and the 8 milkmaids in their long dresses perched on stools. In stools. Now for the sound. Drummers drumming, 12 of them. Pipers piping, times 11. In a tight space, an impossibly tight space, 11 pipers. 8 cows mooing, 7 swans beeping and splashing. Geese honking, 6 of them. Calling birds times 4. A trio of French hens clucking away and not in French. 2 doves cooing and flapping. And a partridge held against its will on the branch of a potted pear tree the whole time screaming bloody murder. This all took place under hot lights in a tightly packed space with a fantastic 7-piece jazz band playing live and loud with an amplified former band singer performing the longest song in the Christmas canon. It was brilliant and awful and surreal. A nightmare version of Noah's Ark crammed into the Marx Brothers train compartment. A medieval-themed subway car at rush hour, complete with barnyard animals and bagpipes. You've got the picture now. Enjoy it. The number happened. A Herculean Christmas miracle that mostly went unnoticed and largely unappreciated by the viewing public. The show aired in the middle of the day, mostly to an audience of sick schoolchildren and bored housewives. There were never reruns, and extravaganzas like the one Paulette pulled off single-handed happened routinely on bigger shows, shows produced on giant sound stages in Hollywood, shows produced weekly, or Christmas specials with giant budgets and crews who had weeks to prepare and all the money they needed. Paulette managed to pull together a major production number with no money and no time and no help. But no one at home fully appreciated her efforts because they didn't know she did it in a day, because things like that happen all the time on television. And it's our job to make things that are impossible look easy. Watching at home, they only saw the onstage bedlam and heard the accompanying cacophony, the studio audience screaming with uncontrollable laughter as the crowd onstage multiplied beyond all reason, their hysteria spreading like wildfire onto the stage and scaring the birds, spooking the cows, and cracking up the humans. These sorts of weird spectacles are particularly notable only when you realize that one person did it in one day with very little money, precious little experience, and no support at all. While I never overheard any scheming or plotting about this particular challenge, I have observed firsthand that some men in mostly male environments take delight in tripping up women who invade their turf. And no one will ever convince me that some men folk don't deliberately set up us women folk for public failure from time to time. I'm guessing this might have been one of those times. But Paulette did not fall into the trap. She triumphed, and it was epic. Anyway, that idiot associate producer, whose name I will not share here, went on to minor fame and relative glory, all on Paulette's coattails, and doubtless the coattails of countless others since. That day, I learned a very important lesson, besides the fact that I'd chosen my best friend wisely and well. I'd always been an aspiring writer, but I'd fallen into using my visual artistic skills because I didn't mind. They came easily to me. But I learned from Paulette's 12 days trial that I didn't want to be decorating someone else's bad or cruel or inhumane ideas, or fulfilling someone else's half-baked, stale, inconsiderate fantasies. Associate producers gave precious little consideration to those who worked to make their half-baked ideas real. It didn't matter to them what kind of hell they created every day for their faceless minions. Planning a segment, it was as easy for them to order up a dog as a whole menagerie. It never crossed their minds that some nameless flunky they barely acknowledged had only a few hours to find a dog and a trainer, or to round up a whole zoo. I wanted to be the one coming up with ideas, not only because I believed my ideas were smarter and far more solid and original, but because, unlike those stooges spitballing bad ideas from their comfy offices, I understood production enough to keep in mind such parameters and limits as time and budget and human effort. Asking for the impossible isn't kind when it's not necessary, and it's rarely worth such human struggle to feed the ego of a thoughtless, ambitious boss who takes the credit for all the work others do. These are questions well worth considering in television and everywhere else. The real show that day was backstage for the 12 hours of hell before the chaotic mess on that stage that lasted the length of a song. And very few bore witness, but I did.
Paulette survived. I couldn't believe she pulled it off, and neither could she. But in television, there's no rest for the weary and no applause for anyone but those in the spotlight. For those of us behind the scenes, there's only another day, another show. The very next day, I'm sure some other careless producer blithely asked my friend to deliver more impossible things, and she obliged. Paulette worked on The Douglas Show for a while longer before making her first very big and very risky move, leaving the union and becoming a director, the first and only female director at KYW. A year later, she moved to New York City, where she directed shows for ABC's local station, until she got hired at ABC Sports, where she produced and directed many of the most memorable, up-close and personal pieces for the Olympics. She went on to make numerous brilliant documentary films and became a true directing powerhouse and trailblazer. She won 5 Emmy Awards and was selected by AFI's Directing Workshop for Women to make her narrative directorial debut with a film I wrote called The Couch, starring then-up-and-comer Julia Louis-Dreyfus. I followed Paulette to New York a year after she left and made my own meteoric rise there in sync with hers. We shared in each other's triumphs and setbacks for years and years. We had cancer together. We even had our children on the very same day. And then, one spring day 3 years ago, Paulette died very unexpectedly and very suddenly. Holidays are hard for a lot of people. We miss our loved ones who've left us here to celebrate without them. Their absence lends a bittersweet cast over our joy. As we go through life, we find the people we love, and we lose the people we love. At the end of every year, we are flooded with memories of simpler, happier times with those people we've lost. We all long to return to a time when we had our families intact. We all wish we could party with our departed friends once more. I miss my best friend every single day, and I always will. Once upon a time, we were just two short Jewish chicks with really big dreams. And most of our dreams came true. But we always dreamed of growing old together. And I guess I'm going to have to do that without her. I will always have the 12 Days of Christmas. That totally annoying song will always rocket me right back to Paulette and those precious early days in television we shared. I will always love that stupid song. And I will always love Paulette.
A Partridge in a Pear Tree, a true story about my best friend Paulette, was written by Sherry Coben and performed by Sylvie Zamora.
Thanks for listening. Please stop by our website, lifelabnotes.com, and read about the very cool writers, actors, and musicians who joined in on this project. And follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at lifelabnotes. And spread the word. Wait, more importantly, spread some joy.